Here we come, walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet.
Hey, hey, we're the monkeys, and people say we're monkeying around. But we're too busy singing to put anybody down.
We go where we want to, do what we like to do. Only time to get restless. There's always something new.
Hey, hey, we're the monkeys, and people say we're monkeys.
All right, good evening. It is Friday, February 23rd. Wow, 2007. Where I live, there's a blizzard warning. It's minus 32 degrees out, and we're expecting a foot of snow. Do you feel sorry for me? The Dana Pretzer Show is coming up next here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Of course, our webpage is www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. That's www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. You can also find us on Trust Cable Channel 46 down in Alabama on satellite W3957 if you have one of those Motorola 4D TV receivers, or on AMC3 Transponder 7. Indigenous Cipher 2 audio. The podcast and replays can be picked up on the webpage. Tonight, Dr. Judith Orloff, she's a medical doctor, author of the new book, Second Sight, How to Discover Your Psychic Gifts. Then Dave Holloway will be here to talk about a new foundation, the Natalie Holloway Foundation. Murray Wood, a father who has his children abducted to Japan. You know, that's such a sad story. These parents from all over the world who are looking for their children, but Japan won't do anything to help. And then Brooke Hart, the lawyer for Dog the Bounty Hunter, will be here. There's been a lot of misinformation out there about Dog and his case, and Brooke will be here to straighten that out. That's tonight on the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. This is the Scared Monkeys Radio Network. My name is Dana Pretzer, and just by coincidence, we call the show the Dana Pretzer Show. Dr. Judith Orloff is a psychic medical doctor who combines the psychic world with traditional medicine, and she describes that best in her new best-selling book, Second Sight. I want you, when the interview is over, because you're listening to it right now, to go to her website, which is drjudithorloff.com. The doctor is D-R, and then Judith Orloff is O-R-L-O-F-F.com, to find out more about the book. And it's my pleasure to have Dr. Orloff with us tonight. Dr. Orloff, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Now, everyone has a preconceived notion as to what a psychic is or what a psychic does. Some will shake their heads and say, huh? I'm one that actually believes in this type of ability, if that is a correct word for this, and hopefully you'll be able to help me with that. But what I find very unique about you is the fact that you're a medical doctor, and you combine both your ability and your medical training to help heal people, to help save their relationships sometimes, and use that energy and your intuition to work to their betterment. Tell us a little bit about you, and then we'll get into your new book.
Yes, well, I'm a psychic. I'm also a psychiatrist. So I combine everything in the psychic world with my traditional medical knowledge because I really believe that it's possible to do both. And I also teach my patients how to develop their own psychic abilities, too, as part of getting in touch with themselves and as part of psychotherapy. And I feel this is a new wave of medicine. I think that, you know, as doctors, as healers, we have to incorporate our own intuitions, our own sense of spirituality, along with everything that, you know, I was traditionally taught in medical training. But the thing is, as I describe in Second Sight, I was a child who had premonitions, and it used to scare my parents. My parents were both doctors,
right.
And I came from a lineage of 25 doctors in my family. And I was this little girl who would predict death and illnesses and earthquakes. I lived in Los Angeles.
Right.
And so my parents would just get more and more upset where they finally told me, never mention another one of your dreams or predictions again at home. So I grew up believing there was something wrong with me, that I was somehow able to, I was causing these things I was able to predict. And so I grew up very alone as a psychic child. And I was an only child also, so I didn't have any friends, any people to really say, honey, this is natural, this is a beautiful part of intuition, you know, let me help you develop it. I didn't have any of that. And I was just alone with my own ability. And so now, you know, as a psychiatrist, I'm just so happy to be able to help people and children and parents, you know, just accept this as a very natural part of development, a beautiful part of development that we all have.
I'm looking at a very powerful computer that I use for my broadcast, and I have another computer across the room that my children use, and it's the age of technology, and the computer operates everything and anything. But the human body's computer is the mind and the brain, and without that, I think, and without the proper usage of that, we'd be in big trouble. How important is that intuition, that psychic ability, to your cognitive thinking? I'm a policeman when I'm not doing the show. Policemen have instinct. They have reaction. I have a guy that I work with. I swear to goodness that he is psychic because he'll say to me, we're going to have a stabbing tonight, or we're going to have something tonight. And it's a good guess. But sometimes he's right on, and that's the scary or the amazing part of it. Let's talk about the mind and intuition.
Well, I believe we need to use both. I mean, certainly as a police officer, you know, and me as a psychiatrist, as a healer, we need to be able to use everything that we have. And I think the mistake that people make is saying we have to be either or.
Right.
Or that we're either intuitive or that we're either analytical. You know, I am both and I use both, but you have to know when to appropriately use both. And the problem is if people get stuck in their heads all the time and are thinking all the time, they can't hear their intuition.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're not in touch with it. And so what I've learned to do in my life, in my own body and in mind, is to be able to switch back and forth with both. And with every single patient, I tune in psychically, and I get information. I'll get information about their past, present, and future. I'll get information about what I need to work on to help heal them. I'll get information about their energy fields, because I can read the subtle energy fields, or chi, the vital life energy that comes off of everyone's body. I can do all that. And so it's just very important to be that instinctual and then also to be, you know, very thoughtful and analytical and logical. So I'm a big proponent of both.
Let's go back to your childhood. Your first premonition, and that's probably the wrong word, and I apologize for that, of an earthquake or something serious. How scary is it to a child? And let's roll that over one more to the parent who thinks that their child has this ability.
Well, it was very scary. You know, in Second Sight, I talk about how alone I felt, how scared I felt, because I thought I was causing these things.
Right.
I mean, when you're a little girl, you know, you don't know anything. You know, you just, all you know is that you're able to pick up these things. Your parents are being scared, and it's not good. Whatever it is, it's not good. And so, if parents don't understand this in children, then, you know, they could look at them like the bad seed, you know, or think they're psychotic. You know, a lot of times psychic predictions are equated with psychotic behavior, because sometimes they are associated, but with children, it's not typically the case. You see, but in traditional psychiatry, we equate psychic with psychotic. And when I was going through medical school, I would see patients rolled in on gurneys when I would work in the emergency rooms, claiming to be psychic, claiming to talk to God, but also being blatantly psychotic. And so, you know, at that point in my life, I decided it probably wasn't safe or appropriate to include psychic abilities in medicine. And so for many years during my training at USC and UCLA in my residency program, I didn't use my psychic abilities at all because I thought it was not appropriate in medicine. And it was only after I had a patient when I first opened up my private practice who I had a premonition about. I had a premonition that she was going to make a suicide attempt when there was absolutely no evidence, clinical evidence to point to that. I didn't listen to my premonition, and within a week or two, she overdosed on the antidepressants that I had prescribed for her many months before.
Wow.
And ended up in a coma in ICU in Los Angeles. So that was my wake-up call. And I felt that as a responsible physician, I had to listen to my psychic premonitions in order to help my patients.
Talk about that struggle to incorporate your ability into your practice and be able to, for lack of a better term, sell that to your patients.
Well, in the beginning, I was very, very careful. It took me many years before I felt safe enough to incorporate it into my work. And before I actually used it in my clinical work, I worked as a psychic or a remote viewer with a group called the Mobius Group, where I was hired to psychically tune in to various criminal cases in order to help solve them. And I would be called in on missing persons cases, or there was one postal bombing case. And what I was trained to do as part of this group was to do remote viewing, or be able to get very quiet, tune into myself, and get whatever information I could, intuitive information I could about a specific question. So I really honed my abilities using that technique first, you know, as a remote viewer, and then when I got more comfortable with it, I began to very slowly incorporate it with patients to see if it would work. You know, and it was because I'm a very cautious person, and I would never, ever want to harm my patients, ever. And so I wanted to just get more secure with my own psychic abilities in myself. And I've got to say, writing Second Sight, it took me 7 years to write it because I was so afraid of what my peers would think.
Mm-hmm.
And I had so much fear about coming out in the open about it. And, you know, it's a great gift, you know, in order to have this voice and be open about it now and be able to share what I know with everybody, including the scientific community, if they're open to it.
My next question, how open is the scientific community to this, and was that one of your biggest struggles?
Yeah, it actually is one of my biggest struggles, but I give workshops on psychic ability and healing. And so I speak to all kinds of groups, and of course the holistic groups are much more open to it. The American Holistic Medical Association, you know, a lot of the more mind-body-spirit medicine groups and alternative complementary medicine groups are more open to it. But if you take, like, hardcore surgeons, you know, the good old boy type surgeons, it's, you know, quote, a hard sell.
Sure.
Because, you know, they believe in technology. They believe in hammering things in and fixing things. And there's something quite valuable about that. But, you know, they're not open to, you know, having an intuition about somebody. You know, it doesn't jibe with their linear mind. You know, until, you know, let's say they have a relative that has a heart attack or a relative that has cancer and traditional medicine isn't helping as much as they would want.
Right.
Then they begin to get a little bit more open to other things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you're just tuning in, Dr. Judith Orloff, author of a new book, Second Sight, a best-selling book about how to discover your psychic gifts. Let's talk about the criminal aspect and how you were called into missing person cases, etc. We see a lot in the news media today, the missing persons. I cover a lot of missing person cases on my program. In fact,
do
a couple of them tonight. The Natalie Holloway case, for example.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I have her dad coming up here, in fact, right after you. And you see the struggle of the family, the parents, the police, the investigators, sometimes where every stone is turned. Everything that they think can be done is done. And they have nowhere to go. Yet you, as the psychic, who may follow the case or may all of a sudden get an intuition about the case, gets information, how difficult is it for you to go to the family or go to the investigator and say, I can help?
Well, when I was doing this criminal work, they would come to us. And so I would just be assigned to various projects. But what's interesting is my unique skill as a psychiatrist is that when I tune into some of these cases, I can get the psychiatric background, you know, of the profiling.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can tell what kind of psychiatric meds the person is on, if they have a psychiatric diagnosis. There was one man that I tuned into, a postal bomber, who was a paranoid schizophrenic on Haldol, which is an antipsychotic, and I picked up that he was part of the VA system.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and that's really helpful information, because then you can plug into the VA system, you know, to see if there's, you know, you could find anything there. At least you have some kind of direction. And so because I'm a psychiatrist and I have a medical background, the information I tend to pick up psychically is related to health and healing.
Lately, every day in the media for the last 2 weeks, we've seen a tragic story of Anna Nicole Smith.
Right.
We've seen the court case as far as custody of the body. We've seen quite a bit. We've also seen video of Anna Nicole Smith. And I'm curious, Doctor, as both a psychiatrist and as a psychic, if you see an entertainer or a politician or a friend or someone that is on a path of self-destruction, what can you do to help, and in particular the Smith case? I don't think it takes much to see where this young lady was going, this young woman was going with her life. And could she have been helped?
Well, I would have to tune into that. I think, you know, when I tune into Anna Nicole Smith, she is definitely a borderline personality. She had no sense of self inside. She had very fragile insides that would break when anybody looked at her in the wrong way.
Right.
And she was in enormous pain, just as I'm tuning in now. And she was a substance abuser. And so that combination, you know, plus the low self-esteem, plus having all the people around her who yesed her to death, you know, really was a, you know, helped her to die.
Right.
And so that's just what I quickly get out of my head, you know, from tuning into her. And do I think she could have been helped before? I think it's possible, but I think it's unlikely. I think she was on a kind of a disaster course with everything around her. She had not one person in her life to tell her the truth about things, except that bodyguard had a little bit. He's the only one who has any ring of authenticity to me who was helpful.
I think the Florida judge, when he termed some of them as enablers, was very accurate. Our time is going by very quickly, and I wanted to get in a little bit about the spiritual aspect of what you do.
Oh, well, the way I tune into psychic abilities is always from my heart and always with regard to tuning into a greater force. I don't ever tune in just for the information. It's always tuning into something greater than myself. Always. Since I've been a little girl, I've always looked up at the sky, and I've always been attracted to the great expanse of space and the unknown, something that really fascinates me. And so when I tune in psychically, that's where I go. And that's where I teach my patients to go. And that's what's in second sight, you know, how to go there and how to be grounded and comfortable and go there and not be overwhelmed. So it's an integral part of how I tune in psychically.
As a police officer for the last 24 years, it's very difficult to shut off the police officer in you.
Yeah.
And to be an everyday guy.
Yeah, I bet.
I sleep little. I think lots.
There's
always something going through my mind.
Yeah.
I use my talk show as an escape. And if I had the opportunity to leave my profession and do this type of work, and as far as talking to people on a full-time basis, it would take me 3 seconds to do that. I want you to comment just quickly about that person, whether he's the psychiatrist, the police officer, the doctor, or whoever, that can't be themselves, both from the psychiatrist and the psychic point of view, but they have so much built up inside them, but it is so difficult to share that because they're busy listening to what other people are doing, yourself included.
Oh, God, I mean, I definitely don't do this all the time. You know, I take time off. If I go to a party, you know, and people learn I'm a psychiatrist and a psychic and an author, what they immediately come up to me, you know, they tell me their life story.
Right.
They begin. I could just see it starting up. I see their mouth starting to move. You know, really, it's horrible. It's a nightmare.
I'll
if I
bet.
Didn't know how to set limits,
yeah.
It would be a nightmare. I couldn't go anywhere. I'd have to listen to people. And I love listening to people. I just need to do it on my own time. And so at those moments when people start up with the life story, I say, here, you know, here's my card, or, you know, I'm really taking time off now. And I do it in a really nice way. But I need time off from this. It's overwhelming. And if I were to tune in psychically all the time to everything, I would be dead. I couldn't. Wouldn't want to. And people, you know, especially men, it's really interesting. They always think I'm reading their minds. It's a real bummer because they assume I'm, you know, every guy I go out with them, you know, I'm reading their minds, and I'm definitely not doing that. It's not something I do. I do it with my work. I do it when I'm asked to do it. You know, I do it if something jumps out at me, but I don't go in and intrusively try and read people's minds. That doesn't have any appeal to me. You know, and plus it's great to have time off.
Absolutely.
You know, but people assume that's all you want to do is read their minds and find out what's going on with them, and that's so not where I'm coming from.
Listen, I want to thank you for joining us this evening. The book is Second Sight, Dr. Judith Orloff. The webpage is drjudithorloff.com, drjudithorloff.com. Love to have you back on the show sometime and appreciate you joining us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am.
Bye.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back with Dave Holloway.
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you're about to see is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
This is the Dana Pretzer Show for February 23rd, 2007. The main purpose of the Natalie Holloway Foundation is to provide the immediate family of U.S. citizens with information and financial assistance to locate and recover missing family members designated as endangered, at risk by law enforcement in foreign countries. I've got one of the people behind the Natalie Holloway Foundation with me. I want you to make sure and go to that webpage, though, at www.NatalieHollowayFoundation.net. Natalie is spelled N-A-T-A-L-E-E, Holloway, H-O-L-L-O-W-A-Y, Foundation.net. Dave Holloway, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Dinah.
Always nice to have you. Tell us about the Natalie Holloway Foundation, what got you going with this, obviously the disappearance of your daughter. But it's something that has amazed me about you and your family and everyone I've talked to regarding this case is not only do you have your own struggle, which hasn't been answered yet, but you want to help and you're doing a lot to help others. Tell us a little bit about the foundation.
Well, Dana, it's like you said, it's all about helping people. We had a lot of help and still continue to receive a lot of help and support from a lot of people in trying to find answers for Natalie, and make no mistake about it, we're still fully involved. But you know, you get into a situation where you pause and say, hey, things have slowed down. How can I help someone else? And you know, we thought it was a good idea. Some of us got together, you know, when I was in the process of writing the book. And of course, we used some of the expenses to continue searching for Natalie. But, you know, I always thought that we'd find resolution in the near future. And of course, this has been going on, this foundation work, for about a year now. And, and we finally got the website up and, you know, up and running and trying to get sponsors and, you know, to keep us going.
In fact, there's a tax-deductible aspect to it. Those that donate can deduct it from their taxes, and you even have an offer as far as some signed books, I think.
Yes, that's correct. It's a 501c3 corporation. It's nonprofit. Any donation is tax-deductible. You can claim it off your income taxes just as if you were making any other charitable donation. So, but, yes, we... had some extra books, and we proposed that if we get at least a $100 donation, we'll send them a free book, you know.
Now, the tragedy, the shock, the whatever, as far as having a missing loved one, is just that. You would move heaven and earth to find your loved one and to get answers. I know that about you, and I know that about any other person who has a missing loved one. But something that is so hard to work with is the cost involved, right down from advertising to travel to flyers to you name it. It's incredible, and it can certainly hinder a family search for a loved one. Let's talk about the financial aspect of this a little bit and how you may be able to help.
Well, the financial aspect of it, as you're aware, Dana, we limited the scope of our mission statement to, you know, people traveling outside the country.
Right.
You know, I saw situations where, you know, we got on the island and we had individuals get on the island and get nervous about things, and we called the FBI, and the FBI says, well, I'm sorry, we can't help you. You're on your own. You're in a foreign country. And, you know, when you get off in a situation like that, you know, the people are different. It's obviously a different country, and you know, you look at their police department and whatever country it may be, and you know, and we felt like that, you know, we just need to help somebody, whether it's a private investigator, whether it's airfare or whatever, to help ease that burden. And that's what we plan to do, and we plan to grow this organization.
If you're just tuning in, Dave Holloway is with me. We're talking about the Natalie Holloway Foundation. The webpage is www.nataliehollowayfoundation.net. That's www.nataliehollowayfoundation.net. Just to get updated a little bit on some of the ongoing aspects of the investigation into the search for Natalie, Dave, there's been some reports of information regarding phone taps and Paulus Vandersloot, and some information that was never known of or never at least released to the public until recently, as far as things that Paulus has said. I'm curious about if you can comment about these pieces of information that have been released to the media.
No, Dana, I could not. We have not really been updated since the Dutch have taken over the investigation, and especially since Karen Jansen has left. I think they're kind of holding things pretty close to the vest. And that's, you know, the last update we had was when John went to Aruba,
right,
and spoke with Karen Jansen before, you know, she left her post. So that's something I couldn't get into, and something I really don't would not want to get into.
Okay, fair enough, and I do certainly understand your answer. The foundation itself needs to be publicized as much as we can, and that is my goal, and I'm sure the media's goal, in order to help this foundation and any other foundation. I Mark Lunsford's foundation for Jessica's Law comes to mind immediately, and many others. Let's talk a little bit about the media, Dave. The media is a strange bedfellow, for sure. We've seen a lot of Anna Nicole Smith non-stop coverage for the last few days, and it makes me, as a media person, somewhat angry because there are many missing people, many unsolved cases, many loved ones who are looking for family members or answers to cases that would love to have that media time in order to tell their story or to ask for help. I'm curious, as far as your aspect, as far as the media, how you've been looked after by them and what kind of job they're doing today.
Well, in the beginning, Dana, I've always said this, if the media hadn't shown up when they did, our case would have been swept under the rug and it would have been closed. And they kept it alive, and basically we got ourselves in a situation where we were able to get the pressure of whether it's boycott or tourism or whatever. The Dutch took over, and that's what we had asked for, is some level of competent investigators who were not closely tied to the investigation. As you're aware, the suspect and his father, had close connections. You're looking at a small island with a lot of people who are closely connected, and as a lot of people said, their heads were turned and favors probably were made.
Yeah, no doubt about it. If you just any
and to comment further, even in my own backyard here in Mississippi, a classic case of the media not being involved or whatever. It was a local case, a couple hundred miles from here, that I'm going to participate in a search probably next week if the weather permits. But this was a case where a young girl was shot and allegedly buried in a shallow grave, and it did not receive, it received very little media attention. I think it was pretty much localized to one particular county, and this individual was from out of state, and we didn't even know about it. Mm-hmm. And this happened about 3 years ago, and Tim Miller with EquiSearch received a call, and he asked me about the case, and I didn't know anything about it, and so we did some research on it, and the family has gotten a conviction with the person who did the homicide, they still haven't found her body, and we're going to try to help this family out to bring closure, hopefully, to this family.
And that's just that. I don't like the term closure because I don't think a case is ever closed in the family's mind, but it certainly brings some answers and it brings their loved one home. Dave, I know your answer, and I know what probably everyone would answer in a case like this, but how important is it? Let's say, for example, in your case or your family's case, Natalie's case, that a person is taken to court and is convicted and is punished, but you still can't find Natalie. How important is it to bring your loved one home?
Well, you always want to have a funeral that they deserve and pay your respects and have a memorial, whether it's a memorial service or an actual gravesite to go to and visit. And that's really important. I think it's more important than probably the justice itself. And, I know in the case that we're going to go search for this individual, the person who committed the crime knows exactly where she's located. And what confounds me is, why does that person continue to hold on and hold this family hostage in a situation like that? It's cruel and mind-boggling to me.
Well, they say that every person has at least one ounce of common decency, but a person like that doesn't at least try to help recover the loved one has no common decency. Dave, the foundation, just before I let you go, and I really appreciate you coming on tonight, the foundation, like you say, has been running for about a year now. You've been doing lots with the media. You've done everything you possibly can as far as trying to help find your daughter, and you haven't stopped with that. A year from now, if we're still having the same discussion, and I hope to God we're not, I hope that you have your answers and we're able to put this to rest. Are you able to give a couple of minutes advice here to a parent or someone who has a missing loved one, say that they've only been missing for a day or a week and are just starting this process right now, this hell for lack of a better term. What's your advice to them?
Well, you've always got to have some, a shoulder to lean on, so to speak, and you got to maintain faith. Our faith is in God, and hope and pray that you'll eventually get answers. You've got to take it one day at a time, and hope that the next day will bring answers, and just maintain a positive attitude. It's very, very difficult, and it's hard to get through. The first few months especially, and it's still on your mind 24/7. But as time gets on, it gets better as you're hopefully going through a healing process. But we're still active and we're still committed that we're going to get to the bottom of it and find out exactly what happened.
Absolutely. The webpage is www.nataliehollowayfoundation.net. That's www.nataliehollowayfoundation.net. Dave Holloway, you're always welcome on this program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dana.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Dave Holloway. We'll be back in a minute with Murray Wood and the story of his children who have been abducted to Japan. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
Well, I know somewhere there's bound to be a girl who'd really care for me. Somebody that really loves me. Somebody that'll kiss and hug me. The girl I'm dreaming of is gonna love me like I wanna be loved. Well, I hope someday she'll come to me and love me ever faithfully. I'm hoping she'll understand me. I'm hoping her heart commands me. The girl I'm dreaming of is gonna love me like I wanna be loved. But if I ever find the girl I'm looking for, I'm gonna treat her just as good as I can. Don't you understand that I need somebody else? I'm so tired of being alone. Somebody that really loves me. Somebody that kisses me. The girl I'm dreaming of is gonna love me like I wanna be loved. But if I ever find a girl just as good as I can, I wanna give her anything her heart desires. Say now, don't you understand that I need somebody to call my own? I'm so tired of being alone. Somebody that really loves me. That she's really mine.
Oh,
Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. You know, I've said it before, and I'm going to say it again, and I'm going to keep saying it as long as this story continues, and as long as these parents don't get the help, both from their governments and the government of Japan, to recover, you hate to use that term, but to get back their children that belong to them that have been abducted to Japan, in most cases because of custody. The parent, one parent, would take the children to Japan, and because of a bunch of bureaucratic crap, I hate to use that term, the parents or parent is not able to see their children again, and we've done story after story after story, and I'm going to continue tonight with the story of Takara and Manami Wood. Murray Wood joins me from British Columbia, Canada. Murray, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
You know, I've said this to my other guests, and I'll say it to you, and I hate sounding like a broken record, but in this case, I'm glad to, because we need to get answers. And for those of you that aren't familiar with these stories, just go to my webpage at scaredmonkeys.com/radio, and you'll hear the broadcasts in the last few weeks, commentaries and things that I've done. I hadn't heard of this. I know there's been some press to it, but not enough, in my opinion. Tell us about your case, Murray.
Well, in November 2004, my two children, Takara and Manami, were abducted to Japan by their mother. At that time, I had spent 2 years in the court system in British Columbia trying to find a way to cooperate with their mother to co-parent these children.
Right.
And their mom consistently refused to cooperate throughout that time. And so by February of 2004, it ended up at the Supreme Court of British Columbia, and I was given sole custody of the kids, just so that there would be some, in an effort to create some consistency for the children. Their mom had been a flight attendant at Air Canada, and so her schedule was really erratic, and the difficulties were around her refusal to cooperate. So, as of February, I had sole custody of the kids. Their mom was still to have access to them. The idea was, you know, to allow them to see both parents and maintain a relationship with their family here, as well as their family in Japan. And so along those lines, in November 2004, we arranged for the children to go to Japan to visit their grandparents. Their grandfather was apparently very ill, and there was some concern that he wasn't going to recover. And so I worked through my lawyer, and I had a lawyer, and we got an order, a consent order entered at the Supreme Court of British Columbia that said the kids could go to visit their grandparents, and it specified where they would go, mm-hmm. when they would leave, which was November 27th, 2004, and a return date of December 9th. And their mother never had any intention of bringing the children back. The whole thing was a ruse. She got the kids on the plane and has never looked back, and has refused me to have any access with the children.
So the grandfather wasn't ill?
He may have been. I really don't have the details about what happens. I know he's in a care facility, and
right.
He's elderly, but I don't know if he's still alive at this point in time or not. I don't have.
The other stories that I've done here on the show have dealt with U.S. citizens. You're a Canadian citizen. Your children are Canadian citizens. What has the government of Canada done to help you?
Well, the government of Canada has been really supportive, actually. This case is a very clear-cut case. I think often governments might be reluctant to get involved if they don't know all the details, but because I had worked through the Canadian justice system
right
to the Supreme Court level, and there were very clear Canadian orders before the children left, the government was able to approach, like the Canadian government has approached the Japanese government, and entered in, how do we say it, the diplomats speak of formal conversations. They've requested that the children be returned, mm-hmm. and they've also inquired as to the possibility of pursuing the criminal charges against their mother, because she's charged under the Canadian Criminal Code, Section 282, I believe it is. She's charged with
right.
of child abduction. So they haven't, though, received any helpful response from the Japanese government. The difficulty is, you know, as you're aware, that Japan is not signatory to the Hague Convention, and the Hague Convention on Civil Aspects of International Child Abduction, which specifically tries to stop this kind of thing from happening, from one parent in one jurisdiction where the children are living saying, I don't like this court ruling, or I think that if I take these kids out of this jurisdiction to another place where I come from, I'll get a better situation for myself. And that's exactly what their mother did. And because Japan's not signatory, then the kids arrive in Japan, and all of a sudden the Japanese courts say, no, we have jurisdiction over these children. And I found myself in another whole legal battle in Japan, which was completely fruitless. Their system is biased. I mean, I can say that now. I've been right through to the Supreme Court a couple of times in Japan, and I think that the decisions they made are ridiculous.
Well, there was a racist aspect that came up in the last program with Commander Tolan when we spoke last week or last program about this. And my next question for you, Murray, is do you have a Japanese legal counsel or someone that's helping you over there?
I do. Mr. Honda is my counsel in Japan, and he initially, when the children were taking over there, he told me that my best approach to the problem would be to make an application at the district court. He said, stay out of the family court. The Japanese family court has nothing to offer you, but you can make a habeas corpus application at the district court level and say these children are being detained contrary to a Canadian order and that they need to be returned to you. And he said, because it's habeas corpus, it's unlawful detention that needs to be heard quickly, and that given the strength of the Canadian orders that had already been entered before the children were taken, I had a really good chance. And so he agreed to take that case forward for me. But what should have been a case that took a matter of weeks dragged out to months and months and months. And Mr. Honda stayed with me beyond my ability to pay him for his services, and he took it through to the Supreme Court, and we lost every single time. Then, in the meantime, the children's mother had made an application at the Japanese family court for custody there, even though the Canadian order, which allowed her to leave the country with the kids in the first place, specifically stated that the Canadian courts had sole jurisdiction over the children and that their mom would not make an application in any other jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
So she did it anyway, and the Japanese family court said that they had jurisdiction, and they told me that I could either accept service on this and participate in their decision-making process, or they would make a decision without me. But one way or the other, they were going to claim jurisdiction over these children and decide what was in their best interest. And Mr. Honda stayed with me throughout that whole application, and right. It finally ended up again at the Supreme Court in January last year, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we lost every single time. And so the kids now, according to the Japanese courts, are in the lawful custody of their mother. And in Canada, they are still, I'm still the custodial parent. Their mother has no access, and there are criminal charges and arrest warrant on their mother in Canada.
Wow.
That's where this legal situation is sitting now. It's a total loggerhead.
As a parent, this must be like a twilight zone to you, to have your children, I'm looking at their picture right now, two beautiful young children, taken from you on a ruse. Have you had any contact, telephone, letter, email, picture, anything, or have you been shut off completely?
Well, I've been shut off, essentially completely shut off. I mean, I had brief contact with the kids as part of the court procedure when I was in Japan in May of 2005. We've made countless telephone calls to the home. I mean, we have the number, we know where they are, so we phone, and we're always told that the kids are away. We send postcards and letters and gifts to the kids. I've got a website that I post messages for the kids on, and so I have I hope that they've seen it. I know if they type their names into Google, it will go to the website that I've built for them. And so I think that if they haven't seen it, that it's just a matter of time. But I know that as time goes on, it's really difficult for children who are in this situation to take the initiative to recontact the left behind parent. I mean, the psychological damage that's done to kids by this abduction is severe, and it makes it the longer it carries on, the harder it gets for the kids. And the fact that the Japanese courts just refuse to recognize that is what's so infuriating. These children, their mother has put them in such a terrible situation, and there's no acknowledgement of that there, and it's incredibly frustrating.
I'll bet. Murray Wood joins me. His children, Takara and Manami, have been abducted by their mother and taken to Japan. We continue on with this investigation here on the Dana Pretzer Show and trying to help these parents. And they're not just fathers whose wives have taken the children. We do have some women whose husbands have taken children to Japan. Is this a case of, and this may be somewhat of an unfair question to you, Murray, because I don't see it in your voice, as far as a lack of help from the Canadian government, but would you consider this to be, as some of my American guests have, a problem because Japan is a so-called large trading partner and they don't want to ruffle feathers over there?
I don't get that feeling. When I was in Japan in the spring of 2005, May 2005, the Canadian ambassador to Japan had my father and I into his office, and he met with us for about 45 minutes, discussed our case, expressed his concern, assured us that the Canadian government was taking every action they could diplomatically in order to get some movement in Japan, that it's a big priority for the Canadian government, particularly in looking at the Hague Convention, which I believe, my understanding is, it was initially a Canadian initiative that this convention rolling back in the 70s.
Right.
That they're really pushing that getting Japan to sign on to this thing is a big priority. Japan wants to be a leader in the Pacific Rim. They want to situate themselves as being, economically as sort of the hub in that region. And I know they make huge donations to the United Nations. They want to be members of the Security Council. And I think that if they do want to be taken seriously on international stage, they need to sign this convention. They need to get on with the reforms that have to occur in their courts and live up to international standards in this, because it's the children that are being harmed.
Pass along a website where we can learn more information about this.
Sorry?
Can you pass along a website where my listeners can learn more information about your case?
Well, my dad has started a society trying to raise awareness of this issue, and we call it the International Rights of Children Society, and the website is www.irocs.org, and we've got quite a bit of information there, and we've got links to other websites as well.
Well, all I can say, my friend, is that I will stay in touch and I will continue doing programs. I have been in contact with the Japanese government to see if an official would come on my program. I've received no response, but I will stay on top of this, and I thank you for coming on the program.
Well, I thank you very much for raising awareness of this issue.
We'll stay in touch, Murray.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Murray Wood. His children have been abducted and taken to Japan. This is the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be back in a minute or two with Brooke Hart, lawyer for Dog the Bounty Hunter.
Dear DirecTV, this morning I turned on the telly and all I can say is...
Oh, God!
Thank you again, sincerely, Al Glover.
And cut. How was that? Was that too over the top?
No, it was perfect.
An actual letter. Someone wrote it.
Is born with a silver spoon. I guess that I was born a little too soon. I'm not broke, I'm
you better beware, cause I've had my share.
Art.
Some kids born rich as a king, but I was born without a doggone thing. But hard knocks, all I ever knew was hard knocks. And I'm telling you, I said you better beware, cause I've had my share.
Art.
I walked a million miles, I bet, tired and hungry and cold and wet. Heard that lonesome whistle blow from New York City down to Mexico. Some kids born fancy free, nobody never gave nothing to me. But hard knocks, all I ever knew was hard knocks. And I'm telling you, I said you better beware, cause I've had my share.
Hard knocks.
I walked a million miles, I bet, tired and hungry and cold and wet. I heard that lonesome whistle blow, New York City down to Mexico. Some kids born fancy free, nobody never gave nothing to me. But hard knocks, all I ever knew was hard knocks. And I'm telling you, I said you better beware, cause I've had my share.
Hard knocks.
I said you better beware, cause I've had my share.
Hard knocks.
I said you better beware, cause I've had my share. Hard knocks.
Okay, we're back. This is the Dan Pretzer Show for February 23rd, 2007. Dog the Bounty Hunter, Dwayne Dog Chapman, he's been on this program before. I consider him a patriot, a law enforcement officer who does his part to keep us safe. The government of Mexico didn't think so when Mr. Chapman went down there and apprehended a serial rapist who is serving 124 years in jail. It seems like the Mexican government and maybe the American government have had a collusion, that's my term, not anyone else's, as far as trying to set an example. I bring up Dwayne Dog Chapman, Tim Chapman, Leland Chapman, and I bring up the Border Patrol agents Campion and Ramos, who were doing their jobs and who are now serving prison terms when they tried to arrest a Mexican drug smuggler. There's been a lot of misinformation on the media about Dog Chapman, and I thought I would bring back to my program Brooke Hart, lawyer for Dog the Bounty Hunter and his family, to clear that up. Mr. Hart, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Dana.
What's going on here? There's been a lot of misinformation. Dwayne Chapman, my heart goes out to him and his family. I wished I could do something more to help, but I think I'm helping by clearing up some of the misinformation that's going on.
Well, I think the case is generated in part by misinformation that is dated 2003.
Right.
Because when Dwayne and Tim and Leland went to Mexico and were able to locate Luster and were prepared to capture him, to turn him over to authorities who would then bring him back to California, they contacted an individual who identified himself as a Mexican policeman.
Right.
Who actually had a gun and a badge, because Dwayne understood that to properly capture Luster, a policeman had to be involved.
Mm-hmm.
And Dwayne tracked around and found Luster in Puerto Vallarta in public on the corner near a taco stand, and with the policeman went to and did, in fact, arrest Luster. And the policeman was driving towards the police station, and Dwayne and Tim and Leland were following the policeman. And then they got to a roadblock, which had been put up by some other policemen.
Mm-hmm.
And Dwayne was stopped. And Dwayne was arrested, and Luster was arrested, and Dwayne's policeman kept going. Later at the police station, Dwayne's policeman told Dwayne that if you want me to tell what's actually happening here, you'll have to pay me a lot of money.
Oh, good Lord.
So that was the first problem. Dwayne was charged, and Tim was charged, and Leland was charged with deprivation of liberty, which is a charge similar to false imprisonment under American law.
Right.
And deprivation of liberty is a charge under Mexican law, which carries with it a term of 6 months to 4 years. So it could be treated as a misdemeanor, mm-hmm. less than a year, or it could be treated as a felony. Bail of $1,366 was posted by each of the three Chapmans, and they were released. Now, this is where Duane got some mistaken advice from a lawyer in Mexico who told him that this is a minor matter. You can just go back to America and don't worry about it.
Right.
So Duane and Tim and Leland left. This was in early July, about 2 weeks after the arrest. And nothing happened for 3 years until September of 06, when Mexico asked the United States to extradite Duane and Tim and Leland back to Mexico to face the charge of deprivation of Luster's liberty. Now, at the time that they were arrested, the authorities thought that Duane was doing this capture on his own.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know about the Mexican policeman, perhaps in part because the Mexican policeman didn't make himself quickly available because he was trying to manipulate Duane to pay him more money.
Right.
And they didn't know, or they claimed that they didn't know, that Duane was taking the defendant Luster to the police station, not to the airport. So there was misinformation about that. My co-counsel Bill Bollard from Santa Ana, California, and Enrique Gondara from Mexico City have driven the route that the Chapmans took with Luster and the policeman ahead of them to the police station and filmed it. And it goes right past the airport. So there was no effort to spirit Luster out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Luster was turned over to the American authorities once they realized that Luster was not David Correa, as he had claimed,
yep.
but he was actually Andrew Luster, wanted by Ventura County to serve his 124-year term that had been awarded in absentia because Luster left his trial in early January of 2003 and eventually was convicted in absentia in February of 2003. So what we did once we got into the case was, first, I applied for bail in Hawaii to the federal court. We had to show special circumstances. The court found there were special circumstances and released Dog and Tim and Leland on bail.
Right.
Then we began our quest in the Mexican courts to obtain justice there and resolve the case there.
Mm-hmm.
The most recent event was a decision by the Mexican Federal District Court in Guadalajara, which was really a non-decision. Last week it was reported that the court had, quote, cleared the way for the Chapman's extradition, unquote.
Yes.
But in fact, all the court really did was make a determination that there were some other legal actions pending, and based on that, it wasn't going to make a decision on the merits. That's what is currently the situation. With our appeal pending, it will be filed next week. And the appeal to the Mexican Circuit Court of Appeals, a federal court, will contend that the Chapmans did not violate the law, that they were attempting to capture Mr. Luster with the assistance of a police officer and at least trying to do it pursuant to Mexican law, not bounty hunting as is prohibited by Mexican law, but rather assisting a policeman to capture an internationally wanted criminal.
The government of Mexico should have gave Duane and his family an award because Andrew Luster, the serial rapist, was prepared to start raping again and may have raped again before his capture. Brooke, just before...
Actually, Dana, we have some proof that he was doing the same thing in Mexico that he'd been doing
yeah.
in California. That's true. Duane isn't looking for an award. He just wants to resolve this case.
Right.
He apologizes for having left Mexico on the faulty advice of a Mexican lawyer. He should have resolved the case while he was there. and he would like to get it resolved, but he's hopeful he doesn't have to go back to Mexico to have a trial.
And I agree completely, and it's me that's saying that he should get an award, because Mr. Chapman is as about as humble as a person as I've ever known, and he's not one to take compliments well, but he certainly deserves them. Before I let you go, Brooke, I want to get your take on, and you heard my intro, the government of Mexico, the government of the United States, and maybe you don't want to comment on this. I used the two border patrolmen as an example of being sacrificed, and I'm going to use Dwayne Chapman as someone who may have been sacrificed in a case. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as I think I should not comment on the Border Patrol convictions, because from what I've read, that was a matter that proceeded through a jury trial.
Right.
And the jurors and the judge in that case know exactly what the proof was. And apparently they made decisions based upon proof that was submitted and the careful examination of their behavior by a jury is far different than we have in Duane's case, where we haven't gotten to that stage, but we also have a different degree of alleged wrongdoing here, where Duane is capturing an internationally fleeing convicted rapist is quite a bit different than the situation with the Border Patrol officers.
I've interviewed Tanya Doe on my program. She credits Duane and Leland and Tim for helping save her life. Duane, Tim, Leland, Beth, all of them, we see them on television, and I'm sure the Duane that I've interviewed on my program and the Duane that we see on TV is the Duane in real life, but how are they really doing? This stress has got to be incredible.
Okay, well, it is the Duane you see in real life. He's a humble, straightforward, caring person who is very concerned about the misperceptions that have been bandied about in the press. There is a lot of pressure. After all, there you are in Canada, right?
Right.
And if you were awaiting extradition to a place where you had no experience with the justice system and even none with the language, you might be a bit anxious yourself.
Yes.
But the Chapmans have a great deal of faith that the Mexican justice system, particularly at the circuit court level, will do justice. And one way or another, this case will be resolved fairly for the Chapmans and for the Mexican justice system. They have great respect for it and expect that their respect is well placed.
Please pass my best on to Duane and his family, and I will contact you again once we have more information about this. Thank you, Brooke.
Okay, Dana, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye. That's Brooke Hart, attorney for Duane Dog Chapman. We'll be right back.
Consider, baby, give yourself just a little more time.
All right, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Special thanks to my guest this evening, Dr. Judith Orloff, author of the best-selling book Second Sight, Dave Holloway with the Natalie Holloway Foundation, Murray Wood, whose children have been abducted to Japan, and Brooke Hart, attorney for Dog the Bounty Hunter. I remind you, our webpage is www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. There you can listen to the show live, download podcasts of past programs, listen to my daily commentary, whatever. We'll be back on Tuesday next week at 9 o'clock Eastern with an all-new Dana Pretzer Show, where LaFerne Watkins, Southern California Broadcaster Association Community Affairs President, will join me to talk about the Association of Women in Radio and Television, the Southern California chapter. Plus, we're going to have a Hollywood casting director. Pixie Munro will be here from Munro Casting and Production Services, and we're going to talk about being a Hollywood casting director and something she's working on where celebrities are jumping with the Army Golden Knights to show how they support the military. That's Tuesday, and we'll probably have some other things too on the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you on Tuesday. Good night.
Whether I'm right or whether I'm wrong, whether I find a place in this world or never belong, I gotta be me. I want to live, not merely survive, and I won't give up this dream of life that keeps me alive. I gotta be me. Yes.